wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this January 11th Monday. As always, a big thank you to the dedicated KBOO staff who, over this last year, have kept the amazing radio produced for our community on the air. This morning on The Old Mole, Bill Resnick talks with Norman Solomon about the attempted coup by Trump and his supporters and what opportunities the Biden administration will have following the Georgia Senate victories. Norman Solomon is a co-founder and national coordinator of RootsAction.org. His books include War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, and Made Love Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. Jan Hawken talks with Winona LaDuke about the fight against Enbridge Energy's Line 3 in Minnesota. That's a pipeline project that would expand the flow of highly toxic tar sands oil through critical waterways and lands in this region. LaDuke is executive director of Honor the Earth and an economist and environmental activist known for her work on tribal land claims and sustainable development. As a water and land protector on the front lines, she explains why direct action is so vital to this struggle and how activists from other regions can support the resistance there. We conclude today's program with Lori Mercier talking with Mandy Smithberger, director of the Strauss Military Reform Project, about the recent congressional approval of the largest military budget in U.S. history and how to shrink the Pentagon. Smithberger also works with the Center for Defense Information Project on government oversight. For more, see her article with William Hartung at tomdispatch.com and look for Shrinking the Pentagon. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and thanks for tuning in this morning. And thanks to KBOO members old and new for supporting community radio and programs like the Old Mole. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and Norman Solomon.
Hi, Norman Solomon. Welcome again to KBOO.
Hey, thank you, Bill.
Norman Solomon, in his youth, lived, worked in politics in Portland, where his media career started with a weekly public affairs show on the radical countercultural station, KBOO, the station you're listening to, and was for 5 years on the board of KBOO. He also wrote for the Portland Alliance and the monthly paper, I Grieve for It. Since then, he's become a nationally known analyst and wrote several books. He's a journalist, a media critic, author. He's also very active, speaking, writing a vast number of op-eds and articles over the years in numerous outlets, left and liberal. He's been associated with Fairness and Accuracy in Media. He founded the Institute for Public Accuracy, and he co-founded the organization Roots Action. He's put his body on the line in demonstrations and came close to winning a California seat in the Congress, and he was a great Bernie supporter and Bernie delegate in the last two Democratic Party national conventions. So, Norman, the political drama last week was really intense with the two victories in the Georgia senatorial elections, giving control of both houses of the U.S. Congress and the presidency to the Democrats, a quite surprising development. Most eye-catching of all last week, Trump's troops stormed and occupied the Capitol buildings, forced our gathered federal senators and House members to unceremoniously flee to underground shelters to huddle together, with the Republicans refusing orders to mask. And then there was another barely noticed story last week, sort of concealed by the theatrics in Washington, that the COVID pandemic is raging, over 4,000 deaths, the record in the United States that will likely be exceeded per day for the rest of January and February. Norman, what do you see as the outcome, the lay of the political land after Georgia, the Capitol, the right-wing brief occupation of the House and Senate, the pandemic raging?
Well, Bill, you've touched on a lot of important events and developments, and in many ways we have been living in a dystopia since last March with the very deadly pandemic, which is biological, but in terms of the suffering and death in the United States, mostly caused because of political actions and inaction, just underscores how politics is about life and death. As Nina Turner says, the former national co-chair of the Bernie Sanders campaign, everything that we love is on the line. That's true in politics, where we talk about Washington, D.C., or Salem, or the Multnomah County Board. Whoever is in a position of power through omission and commission have enormous effect. And I think that when we look at the last days, weeks, months, years, really, the reality is that without progressive organizing and activism, things would have been worse, which is maybe small or no comfort, but still a reality. And so it's about, you know, going forward, like Mother Jones, the heroic organizer of what, a full century ago or more, you know, mourn the dead and fight like hell for the living. And that's where we are as 2021 begins. I mean, sort of a shorthand is that I think that the Georgia results were certainly surprising to many people, including me, because I was pessimistic just a few weeks ago that it could happen. And I don't think there's any question that the mobilization among progressives, young people, African Americans, other people of color in Georgia made the difference. And also that given how close those two senatorial races were, there was a notable assist from Donald Trump, his narcissism, his focus on himself, and that pushed the Democrats over the top. So I think that the fact that with Harris being VP and casting tie-breaking votes, there will be a significant shift to what we could have expected in a Republican-run, McConnell-run Senate. That said, we're in a situation where the Democratic Party has some very strong progressive elements. I think we could say, for instance, that Earl Blumenauer, whatever his flaws, has improved over the years and done some, you know, good stuff. There's quite a few Democrats in the House who are exemplary. The squad has almost doubled. Cori Bush is in now. Jamal Bowman is in now. Mondaire Jones. We have people who are genuine progressives in Congress. We had very few just a few years ago. We don't have nearly enough, but we have more. And so on all ranges of issues, from canceling student debt to health care to education policies, and certainly challenging and trying to bring down the pandemic, things are going to get better. But how much better they get depends on how well we organize. And I should say, Bill, that my main energies are with RootsAction.org, where we now have 1.2 million people active, including just many, many people in the Portland area and beyond who are active, who have signed up at RootsAction.org, and everybody's invited to do that. It's just RootsAction.org. And then we're doing actions to pressure members of Congress, elected officials, prison wardens in terms of abusing prisoners, corporations that are polluting. This is about organizing. And I think that as Biden coming in now imminently as president, it's very important, and that's just sort of sum up my response to your question here, Bill, very important that we not for the third time make this terrible mistake that self-described liberals and many progressives have made when Bill Clinton came into the presidency and when Barack Obama came into the presidency. All too often people just gave them a long leash, so to speak, forgot that they're supposed to work for us, just were willing to trust and accept. And so Bill Clinton allowed the Wall Streeters and the corporate titans and the functionaries to come into the cabinet and policy positions, and likewise Barack Obama. So what were the results? The results were NAFTA under Clinton, repeal of Glass-Steagall, the horrific attack on women and children called welfare reform, And then 2 years after Clinton became president, the Republicans took over Congress. And the same thing happened with Obama. There were houses underwater sinking when Obama came in, and he bailed out Wall Street, the big banks, and many people lost their homes. 2 years later, in 2010, Congress was taken over by the Republicans. We cannot afford to let that happen again. We can't let the Republicans, with their phony populism, harness anger electorally. We have to be willing and able to challenge Biden and Democrats in Congress in power, and that includes in the state governments, to insist that we need progressive populism to do what FDR and the New Deal did and galvanize support for working class people and others so that we get a program implemented that can work in humanistic terms and also in electoral terms.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour talking to Norman Solomon. He's a cable alumnus, went on to become an author, syndicated columnist. He's also an activist and movement builder, founded the organization Roots Action, was a Bernie Sanders delegate at the last Democratic National Convention, and coordinated Sanders' efforts to win the nomination in 2016. Norman Solomon and I just discussed how the left are having contributed to electing Clinton and Obama, trusted them to take action, to propose and fight for a working-class agenda. They didn't, and both were replaced by reactionary Republicans. Biden himself is a corporatist Democrat. His record is terrible, as you well know when you were courting Bernie Sanders. It seems to me most of the Democrats in Congress are also in the same mold as Bernie. They're really dependent on corporate money in many ways, but they're also dependent on corporate support and corporate toleration of them. Local companies, especially local employers, if they argue that X candidate is really bad for business, that they might move their headquarters somewhere else to escape whatever those candidates can do, that's death sentence for the candidate. I think that's really very important, even more important than campaign finance, but that's another matter. It seems to me we really have people who have spent their lives, old white men, mostly in the Congress, especially in the Senate, Democrats and Republicans, the Republicans even much worse with different forms of corporate support. They do have to be pushed. Let's get into the way that the left in Congress could do the pushing. What are the levers they have? And in fact, what kinds of programs would be acceptable to a left? They're not going to win a full Green New Deal. It seems to me that's out of the question, but they can win some very, very important stepping stones to actually at some point full implementation of the vision of the Green New Deal.
It was really a crucial turning point to defeat Donald Trump. As you mentioned, like many people, I worked to try to get Bernie Sanders elected. We ended up obviously with a corporate militarist candidate named Joe Biden. And yet, although it's a high jump over extremely abysmal low standards, major differences with Donald Trump. And so it was a victory. It was a united front victory that included, crucially, progressive work that defeated Trump in November 2020. And I want to mention that at RootsAction.org, we launched the Vote Trump Out campaign last August. And we had full-time people in several swing states. We reached literally millions of progressives and young people through social media, including advertising and what we call Deep Canvas. We had hundreds of volunteers, and we made a commitment: vote Trump out, then challenge Biden. So having achieved collectively with people around the country the first goal, we're now on to the second goal, which is to challenge Biden. And we've launched through Roots Action the No Honeymoon campaign, and people can find it simply by going to the web at nohoneymoon.org. And directly in response to your question, Bill, the basis for the main programs of the No Honeymoon campaign all involve six specific programs. Now, of course, there are many others. But what we emphasize at the nohoneymoon.org website are cancel student debt, end the wars, Green New Deal, truly universal health care as a human right, racial justice, and fight for $15 an hour national federal wage. And these are, many of them, certainly achievable in the short to medium range. It's going to be a battle. As you mentioned, Bill, a Green New Deal, at best, it will be implemented in stages. Ending the wars, a colossal goal, crucial. And then racial justice, the ongoing struggle. This is 24/7, 365. And I know that in Oregon and the Northwest, there's a long tradition which I was glad to partake of and be part of, where the tradition of challenging racial injustice, challenging the warfare state, and fighting for social and economic justice, you know, Portland and the Northwest, you know, clearly have helped to be cutting edge. Nonviolent action, I should add. We often had a problem with provocateurs and people trying to screw up effective demonstrations with violence. And, you know, whatever else you think ideologically, tactically, it's a disaster. So nonviolent direct action and other kind of politics and organizing are crucial. And I think, you know, to circle back to your question, Bill, I think that there are so many facets of organizing to push Biden. If we sit back and let Biden do his thing, we will have a replica of the Bill Clinton and the Barack Obama administrations. And given the pandemic crisis, given the economic tailspin, that just is not going to do it. We need a grassroots effective movement to bring ourselves the equivalent of the New Deal with attention to factors that the New Deal either was incapable of or failed to address or simply was not facing in that era. And that includes climate. It includes challenging racism and sexism and xenophobia. And it also includes a rainbow coalition, whatever you want to call it, that is multicultural, multi-generational, intersectional. And that's how we're going to have effective ways to create the kind of society that we want.
In practical terms, Norman, you know, your larger goals are great. But in fact, as you pointed out, they're going to have to be accomplished in stages. And in fact, climate change is not ending. And if you believe the climate scientists, we really only have 10 or 15 years to make enormous changes in the levels of greenhouse gas pollution. But there are things now that can be stepping stones, it seems to me. Even if we don't win Medicare for all, we could win waivers for states who want to experiment with and set up Medicare for all programs. It seems to me it would be a great step to have New York State and California, although they have such deep financial problems now, doing that. It also seems to me we can get an infrastructure bill that would authorize and even appropriate things to create model cities, model zero carbon cities with community energy at the heart of it. It seems to me those two reforms would go a long way to peeling off support for Trump and the Republicans. It's not a majority by far of the working class, but he was able to garner enough votes, so along with his evangelical base and the others, to cobble together an electoral coalition that won and that almost won this last election and that could well win in 2022 to completely shift the congressional power and end any possibility of the left getting anywhere. I've thought about that a lot, kind of stepping stones to a new society.
Yes, well, at all levels of government and most important in communities around the country, this kind of work is crucial, whether we're doing it in neighborhoods or city councils, statewide governance, or the federal government. I think that unfortunately there's been a lack of success or a shortage of success in terms of federal policy. And of course, you know, we've had a lot of push for localism, and I think there's a lot to be said for it. However, you're not going to solve the problem with local solutions only or primarily. The climate is climate. We even say it's global. How can we do it just out of one neighborhood at a time? Yes, this self-reliance and doing it from the bottom up, that's all important. But we need a massive amount of funding to make this work. We need to give people jobs, like the New Deal did, and that's with a much smaller population, 10 million jobs. We've got to provide basic economic security. You know, now there's a push, and with tremendous pressure, as with the $15 an hour wage that came from Bernie Sanders, was considered by the elites to be preposterous, now it's center stage. We also have the $2,000 pandemic check that, again, Bernie Sanders has pushed, and now it's being moved to center stage. The day before the Georgia Senate runoff, Joe Biden and smartly said if the two Democratic senator candidates won, he used the word immediately, bring in a $2,000 check for everyone. And the next step is to say, we don't want a one-shot $2,000 check. We want monthly. People have a right to a guaranteed income. And of course, the corporate media and others say, how are you going to pay for it? Well, there's more than $1 trillion a year going to the military. It's several billion dollars a day. When you add up the Pentagon budget and nuclear weapons budget that's in the Department of Energy and elsewhere. So we're spending several billion dollars a day, largely not for real defense, but to figure out how to kill people. And meanwhile, people are undergoing a lack of health care, education, housing, nutrition. So this is outrageous. And how do we get the money? Well, two ways. You drastically cut the military budget. I'm not going to call it a defense budget. And the other is you institute genuine progressive taxation, like a wealth tax Elizabeth Warren has talked about, by a transaction tax that Bernie Sanders has talked about in terms of Wall Street. There are massive amounts of money that can be raised for these humanistic purposes if we have the political power. So that gets the other part of what you're talking about, Bill, that if we can create more and more leverage at the federal level, which is, you know, a big if, but let's face it, we've been in a dire situation the last 4 years. It has been horrific. Even after Democrats took back the House, we've been back on our heels. We've been in defense. We've been defending. We've been taking blows. People have been dying unnecessarily, avoidably. And now we have a chance to turn the tide.
Norman, that's a great place to end. And in particular, the COVID relief stimulus, maybe an infrastructure bill as part of it, relief to the cities and states who are in deep trouble, that's going to be center stage, and also COVID public health considerations, strengthening the whole national public health response network. That's going to be center stage, it seems to me. You're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have to be prepared then to push for the maximum program. And that's when I think some of these sort of models, local models, it becomes important to, in fact, show people that there really is an alternative in terms of production and how we live. And if a number of cities show that alternative, it would make a difference. That's my argument, actually. And my incremental argument includes having these bright spots that are almost in every congressional district, some of it, so that the corporate answer does not prevail. Norman Solomon, thanks a lot for talking to us today. And tell us again about Roots Action.
Thanks to you, Bill, and KBOO listeners and supporters. I want to invite everybody to become part of rootsaction.org by getting action alerts. And you can do that by going to the homepage, rootsaction.org. That's R-O-O-T-S, action.org. And all the best.
Thanks a lot, Norman.
Thank you, Bill.
Every time I sing this song, I I sing for Georgia. Oh, Georgia. Get it all day through. This old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Next up on The Old Mole, we have Jan Hawken talking with Winona LaDuke about the fight against Enbridge Energy's Line 3 pipeline in Minnesota. LaDuke is executive director of Honor the Earth and an economist and environmental activist. They discuss why direct action is so vital to the struggle right now and how activists from other regions can support the resistance there. Jan?
Welcome to KABU, Winona LaDuke. You're in northern Minnesota now with other activists on the front lines of this long-standing battle against Enbridge Energy Corporation and their plan to go ahead and build this massive new pipeline, Line 3, carrying tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, through your region. We'll be talking today about nonviolent direct action and why it's so critical in this fight. But can we start with what's happening now with water protectors on the line of the construction site?
Yeah, so Anine, bonjour, it's Winona. Thanks for calling in. And as I was just telling you, there's a, it looks like DNR officers are going down to my lodge, which is on the banks of the Mississippi River. You know, it's a prayer lodge. We had it up there before the pipe, before the proposed Line 3 put a stake in the middle of it. It's been cordoned off, but we'll see. But basically, just to give you a sense of the lay of the land, this is where we're half water and half land up here. Got a lot of wild rice, got a lot of water creatures, a lot of fish, a lot of ducks. Where the wild things are, a center of biodiversity. We got wolves, we got bears, we got otters. And we have Enbridge, which is the third largest corporation in Canada, the largest pipeline company in the world. And they're intending to shove this pipe down our throats during a pandemic. We fought them for 7 years in the courts and in the regulatory process, didn't miss a beat, you know, jumped through every hoop, did every backflip, submitted any piece of paper, drove thousands of miles, testified in like really weird conditions, like you got 2 minutes on the phone maybe to say something, you know, totally insane. And then when they approved the final line, we all filed a lawsuit, including the Department of Commerce. Joining with our tribes, White Earth and Red Lake, the tribes that have been fighting this the hardest, and now Mille Lacs Reservation. There's 7 Ojibwe reservations in the north, and not all of them are affected by the pipe, but those 3 are particularly impacted. And we filed a lawsuit to overturn the certificate of need, because everybody knows that you don't need any more tar sands oil and that the oil market has flattened and that they're bailing out of the tar sands. And then second thing we did is seek to overturn their environmental impact statement done by the state. And then we also filed federally because there was no federal environmental impact statement. We said y'all didn't see the impact of oil on Lake Superior, fifth of the world's water, didn't check on any alternatives, proposals like no pipe, that'd be a one proposal, and didn't look at climate change. That'd be a problem since this is the equivalent of 50 new coal-fired power plants. So we have confidence that the state and the federal courts will prevail. In the meantime, Enbridge is trying to get the pipe in before we get to court. And so they're headed for 22 river crossings. We're stationed at the Mississippi, at the Red River, the Little Red River, and you know, we expect some more camps to unfold to protect our water in the Mississippi and the Crow Wing. You know, but there's been 44 people arrested so far, probably some more arrests today. We expect a mass, some more arrests on the weekend. You know, this is a pipeline project that shouldn't happen. And it's sad that we got to this point where, you know, we're all standing out here and it's, you know, 2 degrees out or 10 degrees out. And we're standing facing a line of police, you know, protecting a Canadian multinational. So they're trying to put the pipe in before we get to court. When we get to court, we expect kind of the same outcome as Dakota Access and Keystone, which is no. And we're going to fight them all the way. We're going to fight them all the way.
There are many fronts to this struggle. Can you speak to nonviolent direct action as a tactic and why it's so critical there now? There are clearly many strategies that water protectors have pursued in resisting this project, but why is direct action literally putting bodies on the lines of the construction site important?
Well, because we've exhausted our legal recourse, you know, and so we're in this place where, you know, the thing is it was super ironic because the day that the permits were approved, the water crossing of permits were approved by Governor Walz of Minnesota, we could say other people approved it, but it's his hand. He's got the blood on his hands for this one. He approved the water crossings. The next day, Governor Whitmer, I think you call it, of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, did not approve the permits. In fact, revoked the easements for Enbridge under the Straits of Mackinac, noting that two 50-year-old pipes under the Straits of Mackinac got hit by anchor a couple times. That was too much risk. So she invoked what's called the public trust doctrine to not approve a pipeline. In the meantime, Governor Walz overlooked the public trust doctrine and instead just decided to blow through, totally, you know, wronged for Native people, totally wrong for future generations. And so we're left with no recourse except for standing in front of equipment right now, trying to slow them down from the damage that they are unfurling. And it's, you know, it's the worst thing to see. It's violent as hell. It looks like it. It feels like a rape. That's what it feels like. You know, and so you're witnessing a rape by a Canadian multinational that's protected by the police. And, you know, we're standing. We're doing our best. I got cited. I didn't get arrested yet. I expect, you know, to be arrested imminently. You know, they're jerks. And it's a pandemic. We call it the Pandemic Pipeline Project. So, you know, you can support us. You know, I direct Honor the Earth. We do educational and outreach work. You know, if y'all want to support us, www.honorearth.org. You know, we work with a lot of other groups that are up here on the grassroots level. And, you know, you can support that. And, you know, you're from Colorado if you're listening to this and you know how to winter camp. You know, this is some beautiful winter camping up here. And, you know, you could also come join us. Take your, you know, since you're in a pandemic, you can't go to work anyway.
Well, we're from Oregon. But we don't know the cold.
Oh, you guys
like
can
you
toughen
do,
up, but, right? I forgot you're from Oregon. Yeah,
that's right. Well, what are some of the lessons from Standing Rock? You and other water and land protectors from Honor the Earth were very involved in the DAPL struggle there. What's important for allies to remember or to learn as they do think about joining you there as well, supporting you in these other ways?
Bring warm clothes.
Okay. That's your basics.
That's a Minnesota statement. Bring more clothes. If you're thinking of coming out, bring more clothes. Don't bring a bottled water.
Uh-huh.
You know, are there
places for people to camp?
There are places for people to camp, and we expect there will be more places. I mean, first of all, you got 300 miles of pipe that hasn't been built, right? Second of all, the place that we're fighting over is the place where there's all kinds of resorts, hotels, Airbnbs, cabins, and camping. You can come out here, station yourself, and then you can get a place. There's 4,200 pipeliners that moved in. And so that's a little problematic in terms of getting some hotel rooms, but my son got a hotel room. And then you could come out and camp. Yeah. Our camp north of Palisade, our Water Protector Education Center, does have a few places for people to stay where, you know, yurts and some winter tents, but there's no point in staying just there because there's another, you know, they probably got in about 5 miles of pipe. They got 300 miles to go and they're focused on the water crossings. So if you want to come defend the program, you know, you could look at our map on welcomewaterprotectors.com. Welcome Water Protectors.
Yeah, we'll post the link to that. And so there are instructions for how people can come and support this in a responsible way, and that the water protectors there are playing an important leadership role in organizing that. In closing, Louise Erdrich, the novelist from Minnesota, said that this is not just another pipeline. And I think you're saying also that there is a lot at stake in this struggle, not only about indigenous rights and fighting the fossil fuel industry, but in building a sustainable economy. You're an economist, and your work at Honor the Earth includes a different vision of a rational, humane, and just economy. Could you say a little about that?
Yeah, I just got out of my hemp meeting. You know, I'm in the middle of working with, you know, I mean, Winona's hemp and Anishinaabe agriculture, 5 years growing fiber hemp. And I'm talking to guys in North Dakota, and our interest is in building an intertribal hemp cooperative, working with the materials economy. Fiber hemp for canvas, since the word canvas comes from cannabis, clothing, hemp.
It's a wonderful product that's very versatile.
Yeah, hempcrete, bio, you know, fibers, all of it. So that's what we're interested in. Like, you know, that's the thing about it is that I don't know why the state of Minnesota wants the last economy. They got a playbook from the 19th century of colonialism that's not going to work anymore. We're done. You know, we need a 21st century economy if we want to survive. So I'm on that plan, you know. And we're doing hemp and solar energy. We got 8th Fire Solars installing solar thermal panels and did an installation yesterday. Reduces about 20% of your heating bill, although Oregon, you're a little bit foggy. But in the northern plains, it works good. And so we're working on and doing a bunch of solar installs. We're ready for the next economy.
There are also lessons from the front lines of this struggle, not only a prefigurative vision through the organizing there, but also the process of developing alternatives.
I don't even call it alternatives. I just call it the just transition, because it's not even an alternative. Yeah. This is like dumb. This is, you know, this is the next economy, right?
Right. We should retire that term.
Yeah, because that makes it sound like, I mean, what is conventional agriculture? Something they've been doing since World War II, right?
Yes. Well, our spirits are with you in this struggle. There is so much at stake. We hope to bring you support from here in Oregon in the many ways you list on your website. We'll check those out, including hopefully joining water protectors on the front lines.
Thank you for your interest, Kabu.
Thank you.
My love to Oregon. Sorry, for a minute I thought you were in Colorado, but I do know you're in Oregon. Thanks. Thanks all.
Okay. Thank you so much. This is Jan Hawken talking today with Winona LaDuke about the fight against Line 3 in Minnesota.
Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind. Oh, I said, Georgia.
We conclude our program this morning with Laurie Mercier talking with Mandy Smithberger, who is the director of the Strauss Military Reform Project. They will discuss the recent approval of the largest military budget in U.S. history and how to shrink the Pentagon. Laurie?
Good morning. Mandy Smithberger is director of the Strauss Military Reform Project with the Project on Government Oversight and the Center for Defense Information. She is an expert on Pentagon reform and the defense industry revolving door. Previously as National Security Policy Advisor to U.S. Representative Jackie Speier of California, she worked on passing key provisions of the Military Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act. She appears in many news outlets and most recently co-authored pieces with William Hartung about shrinking the Pentagon that appeared in The Nation and Tom Dispatch. Welcome to KABU, Mandy Smithberger.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's talk about the recent vote in Congress for the National Defense Authorization Act. Despite Trump's claims that he would stop endless wars, He presented Congress with the largest military budget in U.S. history, over $740 billion, without any effort to justify that expenditure, which is consuming a larger and larger share of the federal budget. What's to learn from this vote, which really was bipartisan with overwhelming numbers of Democrats and Republicans supporting it?
Yeah, so I think there are a couple of lessons to take from this vote. I think, you know, the most important thing that we need to look at is the context of when was this vote happening and what was the other major issue that Congress was debating, and that was, what are we going to be doing about COVID relief and what are we going to be doing to help ordinary Americans? And I think what made the vote in Congress particularly discouraging is that there seemed to be a lot of concerns about expenses when it came to helping ordinary Americans and helping small businesses, but that we weren't holding the Pentagon and its contractors accountable and making sure that we were really sending our money to where it's most needed. I will say with this bill, it is technically a policy bill, not a spending bill, and there were some good provisions in it, including, you know, renaming Confederate bases, some provisions that were addressing shell companies and corruption issues as well. So there were worthy things that were part of this legislation, but I think the real question was, is this really the number one priority for our country right now? And when we look at how many Americans are hurting, I think it's hard to say that with a straight face, but there was clearly a bipartisan consensus to rally around this bill.
Yeah, and we see this every year in Congress, you know, these increasing military budgets despite very few real threats to the United States, given that it spends 10 times as much on the military as any other country in the world. So what perpetuates this system? What explains this repeated bowing down to the Pentagon and military contractors?
So honestly, it's corruption. It's something that President Eisenhower worried or warned us about with the military-industrial complex, that you have Congress seeing defense spending as a jobs program, even though we know that spending in almost any other sector in our economy creates jobs more effectively. We have Pentagon officials who go on to become executives or defense contractors, retired military officers who join the boards of defense contractors, members of Congress who are getting campaign contributions from these defense contractors, and those members going on to become lobbyists. So you have this self-perpetuating system that's making sure that those in the Beltway get richer and not focused on what do we actually need to keep America safe. What do we need to also make sure that our military members get the support that they need? It's only, you know, been in the last couple of years that we saw the scandals with military housing and how horrible the conditions were there. So it's clearly not an issue of not enough money, but it's how that money is being misused and who's benefiting. And I don't think you can say that the military is benefiting, and I don't think you can say America is.
Nearly half of this public money that the U.S. spends is feeding the bottom lines of defense contractors, is it not? Many of these corporations like Lockheed Martin and Boeing have been fined for defrauding the government, yet they still get to line up every year and walk away with billions of dollars. We've heard about the $10,000 toilet seats and these charges that contractors make without any kind of oversight. But what are some other expenditures that are really over the top and can't even be justified by war hawks?
Absolutely. Some of the greatest hits of terribleness have been in Afghanistan, where we've seen millions of dollars for gas stations that were going to be used for other facilities that aren't going to be used. There's this habit that's called use it or lose it, where we've seen big expenditures on crab and lobster dinners. And, you know, with the $10,000 toilet seat kind of example, part of what makes it so frustrating is that even, you know, small spare parts, taxpayers just get ripped off over and over because there's not enough oversight or accountability, and that we've weakened the laws in favor of the defense contractors to such a degree that it has become really hard for us to even recover those expenditures. Our largest weapons program, the F-35, we had to spend another $300 million to address deficiencies in parts that we were given. So we're kind of paying hand over fist for deficient wares.
And with the F-35 jet fighter, didn't that cost almost $2 trillion and never really used?
So it's going to be $1.5 trillion over the lifetime of the program. So that's both for the plane itself and the cost of operating it. We own hundreds of these, and yet testing is not done. And we aren't sure yet if it's going to be effective in combat for what we need it to do, since the program is still in testing. And this is part of a system where the goal is, how can we get these programs going as quickly as possible, and not really looking at whether they're going to be meeting the needs that we need. But the point is to get them on contract and make them too big to fail.
And certainly Trump and, both Republicans and Democrats have been demonizing China, Russia, Iran as part of this effort to kind of create fear in the American public and to help justify these massive expenditures. But really, are there genuine threats from these countries?
I think there are certainly threats from these countries, but I think we need to look at what's the best way to address those threats. You know, obviously, if we were to fight a conventional war with China, I think we would all be in a bad position, and it's hard to imagine how that wouldn't very quickly become a nuclear conflict. And so the idea that we're building up our Navy, that we are building up for these other conventional weapon systems in order to deter China, kind of belies belief. I think when you're looking at Iran, that we need to look at what this administration's approach has been towards diplomacy and the failures there and how that has made our country less safe. And so I think it's important to look at all the tools that we have in our foreign policy toolbox. And the problem is that we've had the Pentagon and the defense contractors calling the shots far too often, and that it's not making us safer.
This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio. I'm speaking with Mandy Smithberger, director of the Strauss Military Reform Project, with the Project on Government Oversight, about the bloated U.S. military budget. Mandy, unfortunately, from the new President Biden's appointments, it does not look like the military budget will be reduced or threatened in any way. And many appointees have been part of this revolving door with industry and in the past have advocated for military expansion. Who do you find most concerning of these appointees and why?
So I'm particularly concerned about the appointment of General Lloyd Austin, retired General Lloyd Austin, for two reasons. One is that he's coming from the board of Raytheon, and he's been working for a number of defense consultancies as well. And so he's really been in the business of how do you make money for these companies and not about how do you keep America safe. And I think particularly after we just had a Raytheon lobbyist as Secretary of Defense, and with so many former contractor executives in leadership roles at the department, it's even more important that we need to reset the course so that they don't continue to have undue influence. And then I'm also concerned that we can't continue to have recently retired military generals leading the department, that it's important to have civilian control and to make sure that we are appropriately balancing our resources. And I think, unfortunately, someone like General Austin is not going to be helping the Pentagon make the kinds of reforms that they need to make.
You know, some of these outrageous weapon systems, I mean, you know, Trump's Space Force, and Biden is appointing Michelle Flournoy, who has already insisted that Washington needs to make big bets on manned systems and artificial intelligence. I mean, what's your read on her?
So actually, Michelle Flournoy has not been appointed to anything. We thought that she was going to become Secretary of Defense, but Lloyd Austin ended up being chosen instead. But I think the kinds of ideas that you are hearing from Flournoy are very much what you hear throughout Washington, and the idea that we need to take risks on unproven technology without really thinking about what the downrange impacts are going to be, that it's going to be unaffordable, it's going to be unsustainable, and it's not going to make us more militarily effective. And certainly when you're looking at something like the Space Force, it's clear that their mission is to spend money and that it's not going to make us safer.
Well, how do we break this cycle? And you and William Hartung have this article about shrinking the Pentagon. What are some ways in which we can actually tackle this beast?
Yeah, so I would say cutting the budget significantly is one of the first places that you need to start, that you're going to get much smarter decisions and better management when there are fewer resources, that you're not going to put forward as many risky programs. Certainly strengthening ethics laws and revolving door laws so that people can't instantly become employed by defense contractors after their government service, and to have more transparency over the operations of the department to make sure that independent analysis is made available to the public, things like testing reports for us to see whether weapon systems work. We largely think of what the department buys in terms of weapons, but we also spend a lot of money on people and what's called service contracting, and there are major opportunities for us to save money either by reducing the amount of things that we have them do or bringing some of those jobs in-house. I think we also have opportunities to look at overseas basings and our basing here at home and where we can consolidate and be both more effective and more affordable.
Well, the defense industry has been pretty successful, partly because of locating bases and manufacturing in states all over the country. And in fact, Oregon, where we are, is one of the few places where both senators and most of the representatives have voted against the recent bill. But elsewhere, including California and other places where Democrats dominate, those senators and representatives have been fearful of threatening jobs. But certainly, as you point out, many more jobs could be created in education, in the Green New Deal, other opportunities to use those resources.
Absolutely. And infrastructure is another place where if we were spending more money there, it would be a better job creator and it would help build the whole economy. So I think there are a number of opportunities for us to reorient our priorities. COVID has been awful, but I think it really helps to illuminate how distorted our priorities have been, that we were not in a good position to respond to this public health crisis. And we shouldn't waste this opportunity to reprioritize and make sure that we're doing what's in our best interest to be safe and healthy.
So Mark Pocan of Wisconsin and, of course, Barbara Lee from California and Bernie Sanders have pushed measures in the past to cut Pentagon spending. But even their efforts to cut a mere 10%, just basically taking back the budget to the Obama years, failed. So how do you see any change happening in the future?
So I think one of the most important things is for ordinary citizens to talk to their members of Congress. They hear from the Lockheed Martins and the Boeings of the world about why their programs are important. And I think it's important for the American people to talk about where we think our budget should actually be spent. The polling shows that, most of these politicians are grossly out of touch with where most Americans are and how much money we want to be spending on the Department of Defense. But that message isn't being heard in Washington. And I think it's becoming more and more important for people to actively participate in their democracy and let their leaders know that voting against these kinds of proposals that would shift Pentagon spending to COVID response is not in their best interest.
Yeah, clearly people, when presented the option of either funding weapon systems or public housing or cleaning up the environment or jobs programs or free college education, universal health care, all of those programs would certainly win hands down by majorities. So it's getting these movements activated and getting people to push the political system to change. Well, thanks very much, Mandy Smithberger, for joining us today on the Old Mole Variety Hour. We'll link to your piece with William Hartung about shrinking the Pentagon that appeared in Tom Dispatch on the Old Mole website. Thanks again.
Thank you for having me.
The arms reach out to me. A last smile so tenderly still in peaceful dreams I see that the road leads back to you, Georgia. Just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my
It is a collective labor that brings you The Old Mole every Monday morning at 9 a.m., and I want to thank our contributors and guests this morning, Bill Resnick and Norman Solomon, Jan Hawken and Winona LaDuke, Lori Mercier and Mandy Smithberger. I thank my comrade Patricia Kohlberg as well for her assistance with production this week. This morning we also paid tribute to our friends in Georgia with three renditions of the classic Georgia On My Mind by Ray Charles, Annie Lennox, and Etta James. Thank you, Georgians, for working so hard to give us that sliver of breathing room we need by flipping that Senate. The work has only just begun, and in support of that work that needs to be done to beat back corporate control of, well, everything, please consider going to both rootsaction.org and Honor the Earth. The folks on the front lines of the Enbridge Energy Pipeline battle are being arrested in numbers that lend all the more perspective on the unjust and unequal treatment by police of BIPOC people versus armed white supremacists. Indeed, our work is cut out for us, and the folks there could really use some support. This has been Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We'll be back next week.